just sitting and clear seeing. So the clear seeing is a translation of vipassana, you know, to really see what's happening. And the clear seeing is connected to insight, right? And then the Zen side is this just sitting, which is not exactly about concentration, in my understanding, but it's about just being the moment, you know, and just exploring what opens up when we just enter the moment as it is, and let go of any ideas about where we're going or how we're doing and actually that's kind of what I wanted to talk about tonight, so maybe this is a good thank you, Brigitte.
No, but I didn't mean to cut you off, man.
No, it's perfect. And I just wanted to share a little bit about this idea of these two practices, and then I was going to just tell one little story and that was it. So this is perfect. That and what I was going to share is that in a way we could think about the practice of insight as a developmental path. You know, we talk about the Eightfold Path, the path of practice. And I think it's a very beautiful, valuable way of thinking about practice, that we're on a journey, you know, and we're growing, we're maturing, we're developing our capacity to meet our life as it is, to develop wisdom and compassion and mindfulness and all these beautiful qualities. So I think about insight as a kind of a path. And one of the most famous meditation texts in the insight tradition is called The Progress of Insight. So it talks about how meditation can unfold and deepen. And it's quite a powerful manual of meditation. But you know, there's this kind of idea of progression. And then sometimes I just enjoy holding that in my mind, and next to this idea of just sitting, that this Zen idea of practice, which is sort of like there's just this moment. All we have is this moment, this mind, this body, this life, this moment. And when we fully enter into this moment, you know, it's like that's all there is. And that there's kind of a perfection in that, that we're not trying to get to the next moment. We're not even trying to develop anything. We're just fully here. It's like this kind of undivided being. And one of the ways I think about it is because I have children and I, you know, think about kids and growing up, and is that maybe from the side of insight practice, this developmental model is sort of like a person, you know, that we're a child, and then we go through adolescence, and then young adulthood, and then adulthood and midlife and old age, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we're kind of you know, this kind of wonderful developmental model. And then we can hold that, but at the same time have the understanding that in anywhere, any point on that path is complete. You know, that a child, I have two daughters, a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old, and they are perfectly themselves. They're perfectly expressing the complete totality of a 9-year-old, the complete totality of a 7-year-old. You know, I don't look at them and say, oh yeah, you're okay, but you're kind of a deficient adult. You just need to live about 20 more years and then you'll be okay. You know, it's like, no, we don't, you know, we would never say that, right? A child is perfectly a child. And is it perfectly expressing the life of a child? And an adult is perfectly an adult, a teenager, even with all of a teenager's difficulties and angst and problems, is perfectly a teenager. And I felt that when I was with my Zen teacher. Some of you, you know, may remember I talked about Mel, who passed away at the age of 91 a few months ago. And he was pretty lucky that I think he was healthy and quite independent until a few months before he died. But just to watch him, you know, and I guess I knew him when he was 70 or something until 90 or 91. And to watch him go through these phases of this kind of last section of his life. And I, you know, there were certainly difficult times and things that he didn't enjoy or want, but I never had the sense that he was sort of like thinking that there was some mistake, you know, this shouldn't be happening, you know, or if only my body was like the way it was when I was 88 rather than 89, you know. He was just kind of just living the life that he had at that moment. And so there can be a kind of freedom in that. So anyway, that's a little bit of how I think about, you know, these two models of practice. Like, can we hold both of these? The idea that there is a transformation in practice. Of course there is. But not to be so caught up with transformation that we give up this moment and sacrifice this moment. Because this moment is where transformation happens. This is everything. When we take care of this moment fully, then that conditions the next moment. And then that conditions the next moment. And then that can... So whenever I'm meeting with somebody and they're worried about the future, I don't always say it if it's not appropriate or something, but I always think for myself, oh yeah, the best way of taking care of the future is to take care of right now, and to take care of right now, and to just keep taking care of right now. So that's a little bit of the background of this story that I wanted to share. And this is a story about a Zen teacher, Kōpun Shinō, who some of you, you know, may have known or may have know stories about him. And I believe he was Angie's teacher. So, you know, I'm sure she's talked about him quite a bit. And he came over to this area, our area, you know, the South Bay, Los Altos, from Japan in the 1960s, originally to help Suzuki Roshi, assist Suzuki Roshi. And I think he was known for being a very deep and little bit of a mysterious Zen teacher. And so in line with this kind of mystique around him, this one story is that he was also quite an accomplished artist and calligrapher and archer, you know, like archery, kudo in Japanese. And he had a kudo teacher. And so this, as the story goes, Kōpun and his Japanese kudo teacher, his Japanese archery teacher, were giving a demonstration of their art, of their, you know, archery art and skill at Esalen. And for those of you who don't know, Esalen is a, I guess it would be like a retreat center, right? Or a little bit of a new age retreat center that is in Big Sur. And it has, I always think that Esalen is one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen anywhere in the world, because it's right on the Pacific Ocean at Big Sur. I mean, it's literally like, you know, on the cliffs, and they have these natural hot springs and beautiful meditation buildings. And so Koban and his teacher, these two Japanese teachers, are there to do archery, and there's a target that's set up, and the teacher goes first, and he shoots his arrow. And then it's time for Koban to show his skill. So he gets his arrow ready and set up, and with a lot of care, a lot of mindfulness, a lot of, you know, precision, he gets ready. But then he turns towards the ocean, and the ocean is kind of right next to them, right behind them. He turns to the ocean, and he shoots the arrow into the ocean. And as it has its big arc and it lands, he shouts, "Bullseye!" And what I love about this story is that I think it's offering us a little bit of an alternative picture of practice. You know, usually, I think our usual activities, we're trying to hit the mark. We have a goal, and we're trying to reach the goal. We're trying to get from A to B. And I think with Koban turning around and shooting the arrow into the ocean, it's sort of like saying that there's a side of our practice, there's a side of our life that we can't miss. You know, we can't fail. We can't succeed, and we can't fail. That, you know, that it's sort of like, rather than trying to get to manufacture or get to some special moment, it's about seeing that every moment is special. Each moment is special. What does it mean to find what's beautiful, what's sacred, what's true in the ordinary, in the all the ordinary, unremarkable moments of our life? That's it. Each moment is it. And what is it to relate to our life in that way? That so that's, you know, sometimes expressed in the Zen school, the Zen understanding about that there's nothing to gain, you know, and it's sort of like coming from this side of kind of like what I was saying in the meditation, that just to be alive is enough. You know, what if we had that kind of understanding, that kind of appreciation? I think sometimes if we're lucky enough, if we're graced with that, sometimes at the end of one's life, you know, I've definitely known people who have, it seemed like only when they had that sort of final diagnosis or final, it was really, you know, it was really clear, this is it, that they could let go of all of the comparing mind, all of the grasping, all of the stories about this and that, and just fully be alive. There was, you know, they don't have to worry about the future anymore. They don't have to strive after anything. They can just be here, just, you know. And it's, I knew someone like that who was this wonderful woman who was a longtime therapist. And I knew her because we did a Buddhist chaplaincy training program together about 15 years ago or something. And she, I guess she was in her late 70s or maybe early 80s, but very healthy, very vital. And she was diagnosed with brain cancer. And she decided that she wanted to live her life as best as she could. But then when she felt like she was losing herself or losing her quality of life, she was going to kind of pull the plug. But she thought this was a good idea, but she wanted to kind of just check it out with somebody because it's, you know, kind of big deal to make this kind of decision. So she went to go talk to Gil, who was her teacher, her meditation teacher, Gil Fronsdahl, the teacher at IMC. And from what I heard from Gil, you know, talked to her and tried to understand what was going on and kind of gave her his blessing, you know, felt that she was sane and, you know, and wise. And, but then when I asked Gil, what was that like? And he said, he thought that she might have been the happiest person he had ever met, you know? And I was so happy to hear that. And also so moved, you know, that this is a person who's dying, who has a terminal brain cancer. You know, why is she so happy, right? But actually, what I think was going on and what he shared and from what I know about this person, she had cultivated this spiritual practice for her whole life. She was a person who was a little bit of a pioneer and a woman of her generation, kind of doing the things that she did in her professional life. And I think she lived on Mount Madonna for a while. And, you know, she just had a lot of, you know, she was a therapist, and late in life, she became a therapist. And not only did she have a full life and this full spiritual practice, but she maybe there was she was sort of cut loose or cut free with this diagnosis. She didn't have to, you know, worry anymore. She didn't have to plan ahead. She could just fully be here. And I heard that when she felt it was time, she threw a big party and all of her closest friends came over and they drank champagne and they had played the final round of gin rummy, and, you know, and then she died. And by no means am I holding that up by saying that's the right way to die, or that's, you know, that's just one example. But for me, it's like, it's interesting to reflect on what would it be like to be able to live like that a little bit earlier. You know, I mean, it's gorgeous. I mean, I love that, you know, I it makes me so happy to think about my friend and how that turned out for her. And then I think about, yeah, what am I waiting for? You know, what are we waiting for? And that's, I think, the meaning of that arrow, is that arrow reaches everywhere, you know. Is there a way of relating to our life that we're not dividing it up between what I want, what I don't want? We're not dividing it up between, you know, even in our meditation practice, you know, can we let go of this idea of that was a good meditation, that was a bad meditation? You know, it just is what it is, right? You know, it just is what it is. And to be present for it, to be willing to meet the moment, however it happens to be, I think there's a great gift there, a great freedom. And maybe the last thing I'll say is one of the ways that I try to practice this is through the practice of leaving myself alone. And I think we tend to have so many projects, and so kind of this tinkering. We're always kind of tinkering, maybe a little bit this way, a little bit that way. And, you know, it's probably wise. You know, it's probably good. You know, a very healthy human function to reflect. Okay, maybe, you know, I don't feel so good when I drink 3 cups of coffee. Maybe I'll just stick to one. And, you know, we're kind of reflecting, we're tinkering, we're improving. And that's one side. But then the other side is to let everything be exactly as it is. You know, and that's the perfection of this moment, of this place of where we are. And so one teacher famously expressed this as, each of you is perfect just the way you are, and you could use a little improvement. You know, so how do we hold both of those and not get caught? If we're caught on the side of improvement, it's like the danger is that we turn our practice into just one big self-improvement project, you know, and it's all, we're always a day late and a dollar short. We're always not enough, not quite there, you know, and that's a shame, you know. And then, you know, and then there is a danger on the other side of, okay, everything's perfect, but we can fool ourselves. You know, we can get complacent. So I think we need both. I think we need both. We need to be able to have our goals, have our vision, have our hopes for ourselves. And maybe it's good to have the grandest vision we can have for ourselves of how we can grow into an insightful and caring and compassionate being. So we have our vision, but then when we sit down to meditate, perhaps, or when we go for a walk in the neighborhood, walk the dog, or talk with our friend, we're just there. We let go of all of those ideas and we just show up and experience what's happening. And we're not just kind of comparing this moment or comparing this person. We're just there. We're offering this presence. And I think it's such a gift. It's such a gift to oneself. It's such a gift to others, to be able to really be seen, to be, you know, to meet someone, to hold that space, you know, it's a sacred space, to hold that space of presence and connection without, well, here's what you should do. Okay, you know, I listened to you for 5 seconds and now I'm gonna tell you, give you some advice. You know, sometimes it's good to give advice, but most people don't want to hear our advice, probably. this is kind of one way that I see the Zen side and the insight side coming together, and maybe, you know, if it's helpful, if it's valuable, to just reflect for ourselves, where am I caught right now? You know, and I think it's going to be different in different moments. Sometimes we're caught on the side of, I'm in this story about practice and I've got to get to this and this and this. And then something, you know, and just to notice that and settle back into this moment. And then, you know, maybe we're dreaming and we're a little bit fuzzy, and maybe it's good to bring a little intentionality, sit up straight, you know, feel the body breathe, you know, reconnect. So yeah, I offer that for you, and this image of the arrow that can't miss. You know, what is it about our practice? What is it about our life that is enough, is totally itself? Yeah, thank you very much. And
I'll just share briefly, Max. I was just telling some people yesterday that many years ago, Gil said to me, "I think you're becoming complacent." And I said back to him, "No, I think I'm leaving myself alone."
Good for you.
We were talking about wise effort. And one of the women said, "Boy, that was a powerful answer." And I knew him pretty well, and he knew me pretty well at that point.
Well, it's a great story, and it's like, you know, I think it's all, I think for myself, it's often a moving target, you know, that it's like there's a tremendous wisdom in learning to leave ourselves alone. Especially, I think most of us have a tendency to be self-critical but then, yeah. And then where is it? When do the hindrances kind of creep in? And when is it, you know, "Oh, I'm not going to meditate tonight. I just want to take care of myself. And, you know, I just need to rest." And, you know, sometimes it's probably true. But I know for myself, sometimes it's, you know, it's a little complacency, a little something. So yeah, I love that. Well, I'll say that story is from a book by Michael Wenger, the story of Koban. It's called Bullseye, but it's in this book called 49 Fingers, a collection of modern American koans. And Michael Wenger is a Zen teacher in San Francisco. And the title comes from this idea of that the teachings, the Buddhist teachings, are like a finger pointing to the moon, right? You know, so these are 49 different fingers. So it's you know, it's the idea is it points to something. And if it's helpful, you know, it's, I'll just read what Michael says about this. The commentary is, Koban took the arrow and bow, turned, and with complete attention and care shot the arrow into the ocean. When it hit the water, he said, "Bullseye." And he says, "What is the point of your practice? What are you aiming for? Do you hit the mark? The clearer you are about what you want, the more likely you will hit the mark or even know whether you hit it or not. What grade do you give your practice? One mark? Zero marks? Groucho marks?" Michael's kind of a jokester. "Do you have a score to settle? Koban's arrow reaches everywhere." And he says, "Don't stop at the bullseye. Keep going."